Welcome to Real Talk JavaScript, the weekly talk show with advice and insight into the technologies and practices currently being used to build web applications in the real world. Each week, Ward Bell, Dan Wallen, and John Papa talk to industry experts about their experiences writing, deploying, and maintaining web applications in HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. And now, here are your hosts.
Welcome to episode 39 of Real Talk JavaScript. We have an exciting topic today. We have Kim Maida, and we're going to be talking about authentication for JavaScript apps. So, Kim, first off, how are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're excited to talk with you because this is one of those topics that, you know, Ward, this is like one of your favorite things to code up from scratch, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the first thing I do when I start an app is I say, let's just roll our own security here.
That's like a total recipe for failure, right?
Actually, what it is I live in, I think like most of us, I live in terror of it. I am terrified by it. And the minute I tap into any reading about it, my eyes glaze over. It seems to be a parade of three-letter acronyms or four-letter PKCE, and I'm just dead. And I'm afraid of it. I don't know about you, but all I know is it just feels like no matter what I do, I'm doing it wrong.
I just talked to experts like Kim. So let me, before we get going, Kim, let me kind of introduce everybody to you. So Kim manages the community and technical content teams for developer relations at Auth0. And she's a Google developer expert and a former biologist. Tell us real quick, Kim, what's the former biologist part of this?
Sure. Yeah. So my college degree is actually in animal behavior neurobiology. And I worked for a couple of years doing field research with a variety of different animals.
Let me guess. You went into the jungle of a technology thing and you saw all these developers going, right? And you said, I'm going to study them.
Well, close, but not exactly. Yeah, so I worked with turtles and I worked with bees. And pretty much throughout my time in college, I was doing freelance web development on the side. And for some reason, it never occurred to me that I could get a job in that, like professionally. And so I finished my degree. I did field research for a little while. I decided I didn't want to get a PhD in biology. And at that point, I think I realized that I could actually make a career out of my sort of side job. And I did that.
Now, I bet when you were doing that, you had to do a lot of writing and stuff like that, communicating as a biologist, research biologist.
Yes, but it was very different from the kind of communication that I do now. A lot of scientific jargon and not a whole lot of translating things into human readable stuff. So it was all, like, my job now is more about communicating complex concepts to people in a way that anyone can understand it. And there was a distinct lack of that in biology, where it was communicating complex concepts to other scientists. So it was an interesting change to go from doing that to doing this.
That's a very big change. Yeah, I mean, it's similar field because you're both technical, but completely different, I guess, outcomes of what you're looking for. So that's interesting. I like the story, though. It kind of shows, kind of keep an eye open for what you like to do, and sounds like you're doing what you like to do. So tell us first off, Kim, obviously you work for Auth0, which is security. What, you know, when it comes to, we were joking earlier about rolling our own authentication, what are some of the things you run into that you've probably seen people do that, and then you've probably seen people use just a off-the-shelf solution, and what are some of the battles you've heard about there?
Yeah, so I can speak from experience here because before I joined Auth0, I worked for a digital agency where I worked on a couple of different projects where we rolled our own authentication. We never used a platform or a cloud service or anything like that to do it. And it was basically like what was described a couple minutes ago, where it's just sort of, when you're rolling your own, it's kind of the Wild West, and you basically don't really know if you're doing anything right the whole time. There's always sort of members of the team who are like, oh yeah, like I can figure this out. But the problem with authentication, I think, is that people don't know what they don't know. And unfortunately, in something as sensitive as securing your data and protecting your users, when you don't know what you don't know and something you don't know about happens, it can be catastrophic. Security-wise, you can have a breach, you can lose your user data, somebody can get access to all of your sensitive information on your API, things like that. Fortunately, I never actually had that, a disaster happen with any of the projects that we rolled our own auth for, but the whole time we basically just felt like we were flying by the seat of our pants. Probably bad practices all over the place, but
which is not a great way to fly. Ward was joking before we started. What'd you describe security as? It's like touching the hot stove and going, nope, that's not the one to touch, and nope, that's not the one.
And it's because most of us are. I mean, there are different worlds of authenticating things too, right? So the browser creates its own special zone of uncertainty.
Yes, especially for. This is a JavaScript podcast, right? So people who are listening are probably working with browser-based applications, and there's a whole variety of different ways to sort of that are very architecture dependent that drive how you would or should or can do authentication and authorization. So it can get complex pretty quickly. And even just knowing which flow to choose, if you have any specific architecture, can be a very challenging thing to figure out. And this is true even if you do sort of use a provider, you still have to know what path to go down with that provider.
Now, you're also a Google GDE, as I recall.
I am, yes.
For your expertise in Angular, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
So that makes it very concrete for, not everybody on this podcast does Angular. As a matter of fact, they do React and everything else. But what it means is that you have experience with those kinds of applications and the way in which those kinds of applications should talk to, should figure out how to authenticate themselves. So where do you start? Like, if I'm just coming to this, where do I start?
Honestly, I would probably start with looking at services that provide authorization servers. And honestly, that is where I would start. Because you can go and do something like Google OAuth 2.0 and get completely overwhelmed. And then sort of you find out, OAuth is for authorization. It's not actually for authentication. And then that sort of leads you down another rabbit hole and you have to learn
about.
Can
you tell people what that difference is?
So OAuth 2.0 is essentially a specification that tells applications how to do delegated authorization. So if you think about it like this, before the existence of OAuth 2.0, if you had an application and you wanted to use a service, maybe like an email service to send an email through your application, then your application would ask the user for their password to that email service in order to be able to send emails with it, right? So now you're sort of sharing very sensitive credentials between different services. And OAuth 2 basically exists to specify how authorization should be delegated in order for an application to use, for example, another API without needing to share any credentials. And then so when you get a situation like that, though, you, of course, need authentication comes in on top of that. So the OpenID Connect, OIDC, is a specification that came about and it was built on, it's basically a spec on top of OAuth 2. Because OAuth 2 deals with delegated authorization, and then OIDC actually says how authentication should work with OAuth 2. So this is where we get things like authorization servers, which are essentially just a fancy word for a set of endpoints whose purpose is to issue tokens. And you get things like ID tokens and your access tokens and things like that with the authentication layer on top of it. And all of this is when you come upon a scenario where somebody says, okay, like you've never done auth before here. Now your task is to add authentication to this application and you go and sort of start to Google this stuff. These are the things you're going to run into pretty quickly. They cover a lot. The spec can be very dense. The nice thing is the spec is very precise. So if you can get through it. It's very informative for both of these things. But it really just helps to...
I was just going
to
say, so you must have read through it then, huh, Kim?
I have read these specs, yes.
And when they don't sound... Are they good sleeping material? Is that what you're trying to say?
So I've read them a couple times. Well, several times probably, because the first time you read it, it doesn't make any sense at all. And then the second time you read it, it makes a little bit more sense. And then after you sort of work through using some of them through maybe a service like an authorization server, then you start to understand a little better exactly what they're talking about. But I wouldn't, honestly, for a developer who needs to get a job done, I wouldn't start with these specs. I would start with a company that implements the specs as their business. So when you have somebody who's, that's their entire business, is to know these specs, to implement them, to give you an easy way to use them, then that's where you should start if you have a job that you want to get done.
Well, and I think the problem is, oftentimes you just don't know what you don't know, right? And if your specialty is not this, and you just, rattled off a bunch of terms that, some of those I know a little bit about, but I'm not going to, I'll go talk to you if I need more. But a lot of those times, when you don't know what you don't know, you don't realize that, oh, well, you didn't do this and that caused this hole. And like you said, when you go with a solution that's specialized, I mean, that's their job. They should know about the holes. I'm guessing at these various companies, I would assume they have really consistent testing of various like hacks, for example. You just don't end up having to write all that because I would not want to write all that and be responsible for it. That's the challenge.
Yeah. And there's a lot of things too that authorization server companies that provide authorization servers give you and make it very easy for you. For example, if you want to add social login, if you want your users to be able to log in username and password and also Twitter or Facebook or whatever, there's ways that the authorization server, the company that provides this service to you, you can just like turn on a switch and enable that instead of writing up all of the OAuth2 integrations yourself manually.
Well, the other thing I've noticed, when you look at one of those diagrams, and they're always, by the way, I have to commend Auth0 on its documentation of this stuff because there's some really great writing there. Do you have some role in all that writing there?
Yeah, so the teams that I manage a team that writes the technical content team, but we don't actually write the documentation. We write the blog, which is interesting because a lot of companies...
Yeah, well, that's where I've been trooping around.
Yeah, a lot of companies don't have separate tech writing teams. They just have like one team that does all of the writing, but we actually have several teams that do that. So it's always kind of interesting people.
Yeah. So there's a lot of explanatory material and then there's this sort of, put slot A in tab B and that kind of stuff. So what I'm particularly attracted to is the explanatory material that tries to get me oriented to what is the problem I'm trying to solve here and what got lines with what. And I think that Auth0 does a really nice job of that because it's a really complicated thing. But the thing that stands out no matter where you go are those diagrams of this thing talks to that thing and then it sends this package back to this and then it sends this one over here and then this one comes back. And I can tell you I want no part of that. And so one of the things I see is that you also hand out code. You're not just a service back there, but you guys also provide code that I can plug into my spot.
Yes. So we have SDKs for various platforms to basically support any stack. But as my personal specialty is JavaScript applications, the SDK that we have for JavaScript apps specifically is called Auth0.js. We actually have a beta version right now that's going to be launched production fairly soon of an SDK called Auth0 Spa.js, which is specifically for single page apps. And this one is great because it actually does even more of the heavy lifting for you. So it sort of sets some defaults that are very handy that the previous SDK did not just do out of the box. You still had to do some research and configuration in order to get it to sort of a good starting point. But this time we're going to be providing all of that like right away. So it should be good. And like I said, it's in beta right now, so people can already start using it and looking at it.
Yeah, so that's great. And Auth0 provides that. I just so we know that this isn't a commercial for Auth0, my personal experience is actually with, and it's quite limited, it's with Identity Server, which is an open source library both for front, you know, provides code both for front end and back end if you're trying to host it in your own environment as opposed to using a third-party service. I'm so glad I don't write that part. And so my experience has been mostly with being grateful to have a client-side library that I could use that does all the talking to something on the back end that adheres to the open, what was that, the Open ID spec or something?
Yeah, OIDC.
OIDC's.
Open ID Connect.
Right. So that's the authentication side of it. Is that, do I have that right?
Yes. OIDC is the authentication layer.
Right. And then it turned that thing, after you figured out that here I am, I'm Ward and I've given you my password and stuff like that, and it manages that, it gives me back some information from whatever said I was okay. Right. It gives me a bunch of stuff that somehow describes both me. Is that the ID token or something that describes
yes.
who I am?
Yep. Yep. That'll be
and
the ID.
And then I also seem to get an access token, which is what I then use to communicate with the backend service that's going to send me data. Is that fairly accurate?
Yes. So OIDC specifically is around the authentication layer with the user identification. So OIDC is the ID token. And then your access token is OAuth2, which is the delegated authorization side. So because you're delegating authorization on your API, that's the access token side of it. So the access token is the one that actually grants access to that API.
So when I signed in, it did the whole authentication dance and said, yeah, you're who you are. And then it did, how did it get me my access token?
So the access token is sort of granted by the whole dance with the authorization server, which verifies the user is who they are. And then the access token should have identifying information about the user, as in you have sort of a subject, which is like a unique user ID. And then the access token can also contain additional information that you can tell the authorization server about granting access. So for example, this might be things like scopes. So if you want your application to only give access to certain things on your API and not just sort of everything, you can have that information in the access token as well.
Yeah, that's what I see. I get this something back. It says, okay, if you're Ward, then here's what you're allowed to do. That's what the access token says.
Yes and no.
And you're using the word of scopes. That's the list of things that's the list of names of things I'm allowed to do, or?
So scopes are actually delegated at an application level. So it wouldn't be your Ward, it would be you are user of this specific application. So when you have an API, for example, and let's say that API has a couple of different applications that call it. So maybe you might have, for the sake of example, let's say that you have like a video streaming application, the video streaming API, and it has all of the videos that people have uploaded. It has all of the sort of user information for the people who have uploaded those videos. It has different types of videos and whatnot. And let's say that you have one application that is maybe public facing, where users log in and then they can just watch videos and that's all they do. And then you might have another application that's for admins of those videos. Maybe you have to be an admin to use this admin application, and then you have the right to like delete videos or edit them or something like that. And so what scopes would do in this case is you would use scopes to tell the admin application that application has the right to access the admin sections of the API, the ability to edit or delete and whatnot, whereas the application is just your public-facing application, all of those people using that application only have the right to just view the videos. And so that's sort of the important distinction regarding the difference between like scopes, which are application level, versus something like user permissions.
Can we go through that real quick, Kim? So you have scopes, you mentioned that. And then, of course, I know a lot of apps will then possibly use claims, mm-hmm. Which are a little more granular, I would assume. Is that correct? And then, you know, some people might not be quite as granular as claims. They might just use what we'd call, I don't know, groups or roles. Can you compare kind of those three real quick?
So the claims can be, are fun and interesting because you can add custom claims to tokens, which can be used to create things like user roles and specific that are specific to individual users.
Yep.
And then, you know, sort of things like groups and roles and things like that are used for sort of like more user groups. But yeah, I'm not an expert in
that's okay.
That,
I was kind of
too deep down that.
Yeah, and that's fine. We don't even have to do that. I was kind of wondering more of scopes, it sound like, are much more at the app level then, whereas
yes,
in my knowledge, groups and claims would be more of the user level, you know,
yes,
what they're allowed to do as a user.
And I think that's an important distinction to make because people get confused about that. The role of scopes is people do get confused about that, and they do try to, they like say, you know, how can I adjust my scopes to give some users, you know, this level of access, but that's not actually what scopes are for. And I think that's a common point of confusion.
Yeah, they're kind of like letting you into the house. What houses can I enter? But once I'm in there and what rooms I'm allowed to go through and what I'm allowed to do in those rooms is something that the application itself handles. It just sort of, that's the way I think about it. I think about it like, where am I allowed to go is where I get in the scopes, and that what I can do once I get there seems to be a different set of concerns that doesn't exist inside the access token. Is that aligned with your thinking?
Yeah, it's pretty close. I mean, the things like claims and roles and groups do exist in the access token, but they're just not the same as the scope. So the analogy of having the house be the scope or the application itself is accurate, yeah.
Okay. Is this a fuzzy area, sort of a judgment area?
No. I mean, the definition of scopes is stable, but people's understanding of them, I think, is where folks
or
get
how
confused.
They try to use them, maybe.
Yeah. Or sort of, I know that this was a big challenge for me when I first joined Auth0, and I was trying to figure out how to use scopes, and I was looking at the examples, and I was just thinking this doesn't give me what I'm trying to do. But it was sort of a lack of understanding of what scopes are actually used for.
Right. Now, let me circle back to tokens real quick. So one of the things as a JavaScript developer that, you know, you'll hear, depending on who you talk to, is, oh, you got to be really careful on the token because there could be token hijacking, for example. Is that still a reality these days where storing that token on the client side is like a bad thing? Or is that something that in the case of with these, you know, back-end authentication systems, that's totally okay?
So it's somewhere in the middle. It's not necessarily a bad thing. It's more like a necessary thing. So if you have a browser-based application and your authentication lives in the single-page app side of your application because you're calling like a third-party API or something, then you need to be able to put the token somewhere, right? If you don't have a backend and you've got a browser-based app and you need authentication, the token's got to live somewhere. I think one of the things that's been coming up a lot is where exactly to store the tokens, though, because historically, a lot of the advice has pointed to storing them in local storage, which is actually not a particularly secure thing to do, given sort of all of your general challenges with local storage about it being sort of vulnerable to XSS, and also it's shared within a domain and things like that. So what you can do, though, is you can store your tokens in app memory, But as we all know, in a single page app, if you refresh, then you lose everything that's stored in app memory. So then your token's gone. You hit refresh, your token's gone. Then you're essentially logged out, right? Because you don't have access to the API anymore without the token. And nobody wants that. That's an undesirable user experience. But what you can do is, for example, if you're using a service like an authorization server, or if you've implemented this in your own authorization server, then the authorization server can set a cookie in the browser that basically just represents the user's session with the authorization server itself. So this isn't a cookie that would like be sent to your API or something. It's not that type of, it doesn't grant that type of access. It's basically just a cookie that exists to say, authorization server still knows who this user is, their session is still active. And then if you refresh the browser or something, then you can contact the authorization server and it will tell you if the cookie is still valid. And if it is, then you can ask for a new token from the authorization server silently without making the user go through the whole login dance again. And in this way, you can like essentially persist sessions on the front end without storing your tokens in a vulnerable place.
Yeah, because that's I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's exactly what I hear and what I recommend, luckily, is that, first off, local storage, not a good thing. First off, it's easy to get to, but second off, you mentioned some XSS type stuff that could come into play. But, I've also heard some folks lately who have come up with solutions where, they're going back to cookies actually to even call the authentication APIs. And I'm going, well, now we're kind of in a little more stateful thing. And, typically your APIs, you want those to be as stateless as possible where appropriate. And so anyway, it's kind of one of those things where it's why it's good to talk to you, because you kind of live and breathe this every day.
Yeah, it's interesting though, because there are definitely scenarios in the world of single page applications where it's totally acceptable to be using cookies to secure your apps. And it's basically specific types of architectures. And this is in the best current practice from the IETF right now, that if you have a stack where you own your own API and you have a backend and then you have a single page application on top of it that sort of sits in the browser but is calling a backend that you own, then there's nothing wrong with using cookies in that scenario. And yeah, you can actually just have your backend do the authentication and your front end's just secured with cookies. Of course, the reason why a lot of people use tokens for single page apps is in the sort of scenario where you don't own your backend. Well, then it's not really very logical or possible even
exactly.
to use cookies.
It's not feasible,
right? Or if you need to scale and you have your own backend, but you know that in the future you're going to need to call like a third party API, or if you know in the future you're going to have APIs that you need to split off onto different domains or something like that, then the solution for you would be tokens. But there's a strong recommendation now actually that if you do have a full stack, even if you have a SPA on the front end, that you should use cookies.
Yeah, and it makes a lot of sense, like you said, but it's like right tool for the right job, because as you just mentioned, if you don't own that backend API, it's token-based, well, not much of an option there. So let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor.
Are you building a web application? Need to deliver it soon and don't have the people to do it? Maybe you're not sure your company has the skill set or experience to do it, and maybe we can help. I'm your host, Ward Bell, and my day job is building applications for companies like yours. I don't do it alone. I'm president of IdeaBlade, a consultancy that specializes in enterprise web application development. We're particularly strong in Angular, RxJS, NGRX Redux on the front end, and .NET and Microsoft technologies on the server. We're a small, tight-knit group of people handpicked by me for their expertise, experience, integrity, and team spirit. Maybe we can help you with architectural guidance and hands-on development. And if there's something we don't know, and in our field, really, there's too much to know, we can draw on our personal connections in the Microsoft RD, MVP, and Google GDE networks, as well as our international circle of really great developers, people we know and trust personally. If you got a project that's keeping you up at night, shoot us an email at info@ideablade.com. That's info@ideablade.com.
And we're back. So, Kim, you were giving us a great discussion on kind of token versus cookie-based. And that's definitely something I think that, you know, it sounds like regardless of what you use as your security solution, I think you'd probably agree, and correct me if I'm wrong, that, you know, any developer that has to integrate this type of stuff should really know those options. I think it's one of those things, if you don't, you might not know what you don't know, right?
Yeah, I think that's really important, because I have seen a lot of folks who are front-end developers. They don't have a ton of experience with any kind of authentication on the back end, and they will always default to tokens, sort of, you know, no matter what. If somebody says authentication, they say tokens. So it's important to learn about how cookies work and sort of how authentication works in traditional web applications as well as in SPAs.
I did want to ask about this story. I know about this storing the access token in session storage because I do it.
Well, I bet you a whole bunch of people listening go, well, oh, shoot, I better go look
yeah,
at
mine. But I mean, the curious thing is that, I wanted to know whether there was disagreement about this, because I don't do it because I said I'm going to do it. I did it because that's what the library does. And so is there and that library is written by people who, you know, they seem to know what they're doing too. So I was wondering if there's if this is something that reasonable minds could disagree about or something.
Yeah. So up until pretty recently, all of Auth0's documentation, all of our blog articles, everything said put your token in local storage. So this is not something that most people are probably putting them in local storage. I think that's a fact. And that is what authorization servers and tutorials and everybody basically for a very long time, like the last 7 years or so, has said to do. So you are definitely not alone. We only recently sort of started pushing harder for not doing that. I don't think there's any disagreement about the security aspect of it. I think
everybody knows that if you could get to it, you've got the access token, and you've got it as long as that access token hasn't expired. You know, so you've got at least a window of time in which, if you could get it, you could use it. The question is, how exposed am I, right? By how much at risk am I? And if I'm not already, I think one of the arguments is that if I don't have protections against cross-site scripting, this is only one of the many ways in which I can get toasted.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, so I think, nothing has changed. So basically, you're not any more vulnerable than you were, you know, like 5 years ago. So it's not like all of a sudden the advice is changing because there's this terrible new thing that can just go comb all your local storage, even if you're totally, like, impervious to XSS or something. That's not the case. I think it's like the responsible thing for the industry, the identity industry, to recommend whatever's the most secure. And so basically, like, one of the things that people, you know, sort of always recommend is just have short-lived access tokens so that that window is very short. So if you're keeping them in local storage, you know, it's not the greatest thing in the world, but a lot of people do this and have been, and it's been recommended for a long time that you do this way because of session persistence, right? So you're not at any, like, higher risk than you ever were. And as long as you're doing things like making sure that the lifetime is short, they expire quickly so that they're not just hanging around and people can use them for a long time if they get them.
Then. So that begs the question, what the heck is short? Because
that is a good question.
Here.
Yeah.
Like I keep here, the keeping same it short. Like, you know, short for me could be a week.
I'm guessing a week is not short, right, Kim?
Yeah, I'm guessing a week is not short for you, Kim.
Yeah, I think we try to have people keep it to a couple of hours, not like a week.
Yeah, no, I'm kidding. I had it. I have it. But I've bumped around up and down. I finally settled in something like 8 hours. I don't know why I picked 8. You know, I'm looking at the user's workflow and I'm saying, how long does it take them typically to use my site, get it done and get it out? So if it's a short visit, you know, you can have a short access token. But if you think it's something that's going to be on for a while and you don't want to force them to re-log in again, you're kind of caught in what's the right length of time. so I don't know. I mean, maybe you had some thoughts on that.
Yeah. So the thing that I was talking about with check session can actually be really helpful in this scenario too, because you'll still have that, even if your access token expires, you still have that cookie, right, that says that your session is still active with the authorization server. So what you can do is you can basically have a timer in the application so that it knows when your access token is about to expire. It can go and check that session, and if the session is still active, it can go and get you a new access token silently without disrupting your workflow. And then it can sort of store that new access token when the user makes another call to the API. They won't experience any kind of disruption. They won't be asked to log in again, but your access token is still more secure because it's short-lived.
And that's not a refresh token, by the way. Dan, I just wanted to be clear. Were you going to ask that?
I was going to say, does that something, Kim, that a lot of these, you know, security providers out there, yours or others, kind of automate behind the scenes, or as a developer, especially on the front end, is that something that when that timer goes off, am I going to need to write some code then that refreshes, or is it pretty automated?
For Auth0 specifically, it's something that you would add if you want or need. So that's not something that we would just naturally assume everybody wants to have. There are plenty of sort of applications where you really shouldn't do that. Like if you're a banking application or something, you don't want to just keep doing that indefinitely. You want to make it be a user action that causes it to happen. Like, you know, when your bank says you've been inactive for this long, do you want to stay logged in? Things like that. So it's not an assumption that we make on people's behalf and just do it for them. Because there's different architectures and scenarios that would require.
And that makes sense. I would assume that auto-refreshing could be a really bad thing in some cases. So, yeah. Is it just kind of like an API call you make then in like the SDK? Okay.
Yep, exactly. It's well-documented and it's just a couple of lines of code, really.
And I asked because long time ago when one of the cloud providers first released a JavaScript library, my company did some work with them to kind of prototype some things. And it was, now keep in mind, this was alpha stage, but it was pretty painful on dealing with the refresh tokens. And it sounds like that's come a long way since then. This was several years ago. So
well, this isn't a refresh token though, right? This is not a refresh token. This is a silent re-login. Am I right?
Yes. Yeah. So I think that's, Kim? Yes, that's an important distinction. It isn't a refresh token. It's basically just checking the cookie to see if the authorization server still knows about you. So you're not issued.
Okay, we're talking two things then. Yeah. I'm talking more of the refresh token part of it. And whereas what you were just mentioning, it sounds like that's the cookie part of it that knows that you're still logged in, technically.
Yep.
Yeah, it's a silent re-login, right? And it usually involves some kind of an iframe that nobody can see. It's a little tricky, I think.
Yeah.
I haven't installed it yet, so I'm... but I've been looking at it, and I too have been confused about the difference between this. Oh, I see the token's going to expire, so I guess I'll silently go back to the authentication thing and get a new one. You see, I use technical terms like thing, which is, you know, simulating essentially what would happen in a browser refresh without actually making the user aware of it. As opposed to using a refresh token, which is a separate token I'm given that if I was allowed to use it, would just go behind the scenes and give me a fresh access token every time I use the refresh token. Is that the distinction I'm making, Kim? Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah. So the silent authentication happens, as you said, like in a hidden iframe. The user will never be any the wiser of, you know, it's like it's not going to disrupt their workflow or cause their page to refresh or anything like that. but it is just based on web message response mode and things like that. And it happens without user intervention, I guess I should say.
Yeah, so it's pretty transparent.
Yeah, so it's just relying on that cookie. It's not actually like sending a refresh token back to the authorization server to request anything. It's just checking the cookie, and if the cookie is good, it knows there's already a session active, and the user hasn't been logged out, and then the authorization server can just send a fresh token because the session's still active.
So, Kim, you were just at NG Vikings, right?
I was.
And you gave a talk on some of this stuff. Was it recorded, or is it something we'll be able to get a recording of?
It was recorded, I believe. And I believe the recordings are available now. Yes, they're available now.
We'll try and get that link. But tell us a little bit about what you talked about there.
So my talk was actually pretty similar to what we just talked about today. But basically, the first half of the talk was about authentication using cookies and how that works, and then authentication using tokens, how that works, the reasons why you would use either, and then a little bit of discussion about the best practices, the best current practices that are new from the IETF regarding how to get tokens in browser-based applications. So I know we don't have a whole lot of time to sort of get into that right now, but I would definitely encourage people to check that out if they want to know about what best current practices are regarding the acquisition of tokens in JavaScript applications now. And then the second half of the talk was very Angular specific. So it was how basically the Angular platform can help you to implement authentication in your applications.
Well, I'll definitely have to check that out. Sadly, Kim, I was there too, and I don't think we ever had a chance to meet up. So another conference I'll see you at.
Right. You know, I think I might have seen you for like a minute.
Yeah, if we did, it was like a hey, but I know we didn't get a chance to talk at all. But anyway, the NG Vikings, if you search on YouTube for just NG Vikings, one word, you can go watch Kim's talk.
And it had an interesting title. It was called Authstronomy.
Nice. I like that. Well, we are out of time. Sadly, this is something, Kim and Ward, I think we could go on for hours and hours and hours because you've shared just so much great info and there's so much more we could do. But alas, we are out of time. So we always do a wrap-up, Kim, where we kind of go around the room and just mention someone that you think is a great source of information, could be inspirational, whatever it may be. I'll start things off, and I know I'm going to say David's name wrong. So David, if you're listening, I'm sorry. You have to remind me. But David Pitch, and I think I'm saying that wrong, it's David, P-I-C-H, on Twitter. I mentioned him. We met in Barcelona, which is where David lives, and he runs a lot of great JavaScript, CSS, spa-type events for the community. And I know they're doing some right now, actually, there in Barcelona, which is one of my favorite cities. So definitely someone to check out if you're interested in kind of keeping up with on events. And I think he's a great example of also someone who is really into community and helps out there. So Ward, who do you have this time?
Well, you know, one of the great things about YouTube is that you start on one thing and it pretty much leads you someplace else. and you could just blow a day that way. Yesterday I blew my entire day watching every video I could find by Dr. Becky, astrophysicist. She's amazing. And I don't know how I stumbled into her, but she's talking about, you know, she explained stuff about black holes and why, for example, this most recent imaging of the M87 supermassive black hole matters and how it was done and the history of our understanding of what is a galaxy, which it turns out people didn't even know that they existed or how big the universe was. And she has this, she knows her stuff. But she has this great communicative style, and I just can't say enough about how wonderful it is to watch Dr. Becky tell me.
I have to go check her out. I haven't seen any of that, so That's awesome.
I put the link in the show notes, and let's get more people watching Dr. Becky.
Yeah, sort sounds of like
delightful it. Down under accent that goes with it.
Yeah, cool.
But she's the real deal. Like, you know, like this isn't, you know, this isn't Ward Bell trying to make stuff up. She actually contributes to the field, but she has a manner, a way of expressing things that really is effective.
Awesome. Well, Kim, anyone you would mention?
Yeah, so I have a friend and coworker who is awesome. Her name is Kapehe. Her Twitter is KAPEHE_OK, because her name is Kapehe Okalani. But she is awesome. She used to be a flight attendant and now is a developer, and she writes for both Scotch.io, which I'm sure a lot of people have heard of, know and love. She also writes for the Auth0 blog on a lot of front-end technologies, and she's getting into the speaker circuit as well. She's going to be giving a conference talk at RxJS Live called, I believe, House Promises, the Battle of House Promises versus House Observables, which I'm really looking forward to hearing. But yeah, she's super fun to follow. And she's got a lot of good articles out.
Thank you so much, Kim, for taking your time. I mean, this is one of those topic areas where Ward and I, as mentioned, we delegate to experts like you when it comes to security. So thanks so much for your time. And we'll hopefully, maybe on another show, we can go in another direction on this and discuss more related to security. It's always a big, big topic. And for everyone listening, thanks so much for tuning in to Real Talk JavaScript. Check us out every Tuesday morning, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to Real Talk JavaScript. This show and all of our shows are available at www.realtalkjs.com with links and notes. John and Ward would love to hear what you think, especially about potential guests and topics for future shows. Follow and send them a message on Twitter at realtalkjs.